All right, let's take our Bibles and let's turn to where we left off last time in Acts chapter 7. So we'll turn to Acts chapter 7. We're going to pick up where we left off last Wednesday. And Acts chapter 7, we'll be looking at verses 30 through 43. So if you're taking notes, this will be right where we left off last time, Acts chapter 7, verses 30 through 43. And this is part 6 of the study of the life of Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, the real Stephen. And so this is going to be part 6. Now, if you have, I know there's technically two handouts. You don't necessarily need them. But what we'll be looking at tonight is the defense, the speech, the sermon, whatever you prefer to call it. I think it's best called defense. But we've been looking at the life of Stephen, and we've gotten to the part where Stephen has the speech or the defense that he gives before the religious leaders. And I mentioned, if you recall a while back, that I had said that I could just do a summary of it and we could move on, but I wanted to use it sort of as an Old Testament survey. In other words, just a review of what the Old Testament teaches, because he does a good job of covering it in terms of tracing the theme of the Old Testament, or one of, I should say, rather, themes of the Old Testament, which is the Abrahamic covenant, the promises of God, and all that kind of stuff. So we're looking at the defense speech, which covers the entirety of Acts chapter 7, and this is part 6, and so we'll pick up where we left off last time. Now, let me give you the outline for tonight, what we're going to look at. For you note takers and scribes. So the first thing I'll do is I'm going to review what we've covered so far, which is the first 29 verses. The first 29 verses of chapter 7, which again is Stephen's defense before the religious leaders. And so we'll look at that. That's essentially, if you think about it, that's Abraham through the early portion of Moses. And then in terms of the biblical text tonight, we'll look at Moses, the Lord's chosen to deliver the people. That's verses 30 through 38. So again, we're going to review basically the first half thereabouts of the speech, the defense. And then we'll look at the biblical text for tonight, verses 30 through 38, Moses, the Lord's chosen to deliver the people. And then we'll finish out Stephen's survey of Moses in verses 39 through 43. Moses, the Lord's chosen, who the people rejected. Of course, that being a key theme in Stephen's speech. But let's review real quick something, these items in just a second. But I'm going to, before I do the review, read something to you. I ran across this when I was preparing it a while back, and I was keeping it for tonight. It says, quote, "Sometimes the greatest danger to our walk with God isn't what we don't know, but what we resist in our hearts." And it fits well with what we're going to look at tonight and how the speech ends, because one of the things you're going to see is that Israel's rejection of Moses was more of a heart issue than a mind, a knowledge, or evidence issue. God had revealed himself throughout Israel's history. And one of the things Stephen specifically addresses is their hearts, because their hearts were mainly the problem. It wasn't that God hadn't revealed himself through evidence. It wasn't that God didn't reveal his word and miracles and signs. The root cause of their rejection and opposition to God was basically rooted in their heart. So we're going to look at that primarily tonight to understand what he's getting at. But just in terms of a quick review, we've covered so far, I mentioned to you the book of Acts. If you remember, the purpose is to show the spread of Christianity from the ascension, basically around Acts 2 with Pentecost, through the time in which Paul is essentially about to arrive in Rome, and he'll appear and stuff for his defense there. So Acts covers essentially a history of the spreading of Christianity, Pentecost to Rome, in a broad statement there. But as the church grew, as you go into the early days of the church, there was the dispute that you remember when we first started with the life of Stephen, had to do with the widow's offering. I was being neglected, so the apostles chose how many? You remember? Seven. Anyone want to take a guess? One of the names of the seven? Stephen, right? Yeah, obviously. And so one of the seven that was chosen that that we know of was Stephen, along with Philip and a few of the others. But Stephen I've used to describe as, you remember, Stephen was full of the Holy Spirit. He was full of grace. He was full of power. In other words, God enabled him to do some of those apostolic signs and wonders. But he was also full of, what have I kept saying, God's word. So it wasn't just the Spirit, just the power and the signs. He could do those signs and wonders. He was full of grace and full of God's word, which that defense clearly shows. So Stephen was preaching the word of God, and as often is the case, there were many people that did not like it, and so they brought charges up against him. And the two main charges broadly were Moses and, do anybody remember, starts with a T, the temple. Okay, and so that's the way in which Stephen's speech is structured. He's going to show that he is orthodox in his views of Moses, the temple, and so forth. But the problem was that just as Israel had rejected God throughout its history and its messengers, so it was doing the same thing again with Jesus and his, if you will, messengers. Now, if you look at Acts chapter 7, it starts off with Stephen has been, if you will, accused. He's dragged before the council, probably the Sanhedrin. But in any case, the high priest asks him, are these things so? They are these things so are. What is your view of Jesus? In other words, the Nazarene. What is your view of the customs of Moses? And what is your view of the temple? Because that was the two main charges, the temple and the teachings of Moses. So who does Stephen start with? Does anyone remember who is the, if you will, person in Genesis? Where does he start his defense? Does anyone remember the first one? Right. So Stephen starts his defense against the religious leaders, the Sanhedrin, by bringing up Abraham. The reason he does that is not only is Abraham the father of what? Israel. He was given the Abrahamic covenant. And I've made the case numerous times that the covenant that he gave Abraham is the basis for the whole speech. Because what he's doing is he's saying God chose Abraham and said, Abraham, through you, the covenant, the promise, there's going to be a nation, a name, a land, and blessing. What was the blessing? The blessing was Messiah. And what Stephen's trying to show is God was fulfilling all of those promises to the Abrahamic covenant, even though his people kept rejecting him. And it sort of culminates with the rejection of Jesus and so forth. So he starts with Abraham, the father of the nation of Israel, the father of, in other words, the promise to the Abrahamic covenant was given. And then he goes to Isaac, Jacob, and the 12. So at that point, you have the nation sort of loosely established. That's what the structure of the nation is. But then we saw in verses 9 through 16, Joseph, remember? Joseph, Stephen used, if you remember, for a particular reason, which was Joseph accepted or was he rejected by his brothers? Rejected. Oh, yeah, he was rejected big time, wasn't he? That's the theme of rejection. So he begins with Abraham and on common ground, because no Jew would say, well, you know, it started with Noah. He would know that it started with Abraham. But then he goes to Joseph and he says, even though Joseph was rejected and opposed by his brothers, was God's promises for Joseph fulfilled? Of course they were. And what Stephen is saying is, in effect, God has purposes, he has promises, he makes covenants, he has his word. And even when people reject him, even his own people, he's still going to fulfill his word. The main point is when God makes a promise, he's going to fulfill it. Okay, and that's what he keeps sort of reiterating. Now, I want us to look at verses 17 through 19 in the speech or defense. So the first, if you will, 16 is the patriarchal period in Genesis. He covers Genesis in this wide swath with the patriarchs. But then if you notice, this is the case that I keep making. Verse 17, but the time of the definite article promise. God had made the promise to Abraham. He was in the process of fulfilling it. One of those promises is that the nation would be established. Messiah would come through. But interestingly enough, I gave you the example of Genesis 15:13. That was the promise that after, guess how long? 400 years, God would deliver his people from a foreign land. And so the time had come for God to fulfill his promise, which means what? God's promises aren't eroded over a period of time. In other words, time doesn't elapse on them. We tend to think, well, God made this promise about Jesus' return 2,000 years ago, so 2,000 years have elapsed. It's been too long. God isn't time-bound, so when he makes a promise, he's going to fulfill those promises regardless of how long it takes. And then he moves into, in verses 20 through 29, we saw last time in the speech, Moses. The reason why he uses Moses is that is one of the main charges against Stephen is his unorthodox, meaning unbiblical, view of Moses. And he's showing that that isn't the case. Now, was Moses God's chosen or the people's chosen? It was God's chosen. God chose Moses as the one who would be his deliverer of his people. Now, one of the things I mentioned, and we'll get to our verses in just a minute, was God's protection and is his protection of his people only when they're in the promised land? No. God took care of his people whether they were in Egypt, on the way to the promised land, in the promised land, after they were expelled by the Babylonians and so forth. The point is, God always protects his people because of his promise. God has to, when he makes a promise, he has to fulfill it, okay? And that's essentially what Stephen's trying to show. You are rejecting God's promises just like your fathers did. And so that's sort of the point that he's trying to make. Now, we're going to continue verses 30 through 38. This is the long reading, so I figure Jean will probably read this because she likes to read the long readings. But here, we're picking up after the sort of introduction to the description of Moses. Moses is just essentially described as God's chosen. He was initially rejected. He tried to help his brethren, and then he goes off into the wilderness, or goes off to the desert. So we're going to pick up here, and basically what we'll see is after 40 years, God appears to Moses in the burning bush, and then we begin to see the disobedience of God's people, even with Moses. So, Gene, would you mind? I assume you will. 30 through 38.
After 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai, in the flame of Mount Sinai, and was with their fathers, and he received living oracles to pass on to you.
All right. Thank you for reading that for me. All right. So last time I told you when we started looking at Moses, meaning the survey of Moses' life, Moses' life is typically divided into how many parts? Three, right? Yeah, only three. And they're each divided into parts of how many years, remember? 40, right? So that would be he was in the palace, he was in the desert or serving the Lord, or prince, shepherd, servant. So he's already shown the first 40 years, right? So notice when we started reading, or when Gene did graciously, after 40 years, so we're moving to the next period of the phase of his life here. So this would be the corresponding to where he begins to come out of the desert, and he's going to begin serving the Lord to bring his people to the promised land. So just remember that. So we're going to do similar to what I've done with the other ones, which is I'll give you the cross references that these are going to all be, for the most part, in Exodus. Mostly Exodus 3, and then we'll go back and look at a few specific of these. But the point is, if you remember, you should be able to, when we finish Stephen's defense, you should be able to go from Abraham all the way until basically the end of the Old Testament following Stephen's sermon or defense, whatever. And you should be able to trace the basic theme. God chose Abraham, the nation of Israel would come through him, all of the promises, a nation, and Messiah would come, and Stephen threads straight through that. So let's look at these. So verse 30, after 40 years, God appeared to Moses in the burning bush, and that would correspond to Exodus 3, verses 1 through 4. Okay? So again, that would be Exodus 3. So if you remember what he did in the first portion we did last week, mostly Exodus 1 and 2, this is a little bit more broad. It basically, if you want to make it simple in your mind, he's covering from about Exodus 3 to Deuteronomy tonight. That's sort of what he's covering. But anyway, Moses marveled and he approached God, and God identified himself as whom? Notice what Stephen quotes. Who, and this is verse 32 and what Gene read, I am the God of who? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's going back to the promise of Genesis 12. The God that appeared to Moses is the same God, and he's the God of the promise of the Abrahamic covenant. So he's going back to that again. This is Exodus 3, 5 through 6. So Moses, of course, has the Lord appears to him in the burning bush after 40 years. He reiterates that he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's the reference or allusion to the God of the promise of the covenant. Then God tells Moses to remove his sandals, and he had also seen Israel's affliction. So this again, Exodus 3, verse 5 through about verse 10. And these are rough, but that's the basic correspondence there. But they also rejected, didn't they, Moses? And you see where it's repeated again here. So in verses 32, he mentions Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then he says to take off your sandals. That's kind of the idea of what we sang earlier with Dave. But then notice in verse 34 of Acts 7, it says, I have certainly seen the oppression of my people, and he's going to come and he's going to use Moses to be the one to deliver his people. And again, he makes the same reference, this Moses whom they disown, saying, who made you a ruler and judge? We saw that last week. The whole idea here is that they just continually reject whoever God sends. And that's mostly what he's pointing at there. Now, Moses, so that covers verses 30 through 35 there, and it basically is Exodus 3. That'd be a shorthand way of saying it. Did God use Moses to bring the people out of Israel? And of course, I hope, or Egypt rather, of course, everybody would say yes. But notice in verse 36 what Stephen mentions about Moses. He mentions three particular things, two positive and how many negative? Well, if you don't notice it, it's one and has to do with the wilderness. So the positive was, this is verse 36, if you're looking in Acts 7. This man, Moses, performed wonders and signs in the lands of Egypt. Now, what would this be? Well, doesn't take much to guess. It's the plagues. I mean, Moses, of course, Aaron, of course, associated with it. But Moses, of course, was given the ability to do all of those different miracles and so forth. And that is in Exodus 7 through 12. So those would be the plagues. And now when I use the word plagues, what I mean by that is Moses, of course, God used he and Aaron to be able to do those. Of course, Pharaoh had his own magicians, but there was a limit on what they could do, and eventually God prevailed. So that would be Moses. He led the people out. God used Moses, in other words, is what Stephen's saying for that. So that's pretty straightforward. The second one is the parting of the Red Sea. Notice he includes that one. That would be Exodus chapter 14. So those two things are positive. In other words, what he says is that Moses was God's chosen person to take the people to the next stage of the fulfillment of the covenant, which is, does a nation need land or not? Of course, that's what we think of with the nation. When they were in Egypt, they didn't have land, so that's why they were being brought to the promised land. So Moses is being the instrument of that. But I want to draw your attention to the last piece in verse 36. And they were in the wilderness for 40 years. That wasn't really a good thing, was it? So the first two are positive. The third is the wilderness. But I want you to answer the question yourself. Were they in the wilderness? In other words, did they spend 40 years going around chasing their tails because they were obedient, or were they disobedient? Right. What's the point? God had a particular purpose and God was still going to fulfill it, but disobedience caused them to miss out on what God had for them. Now, I want us to look at this. This is going to be Numbers 14:33. Now, by no means is this the only cross reference. I'll read this one. This is Numbers 14:33. I just want you to get this here. It's maybe a little bit more direct. So Numbers 14:33. Because what Stephen is showing is God was working through Moses, the people disobeyed, and that kept them from seeing, experiencing the blessings of God. But did that prohibit God from doing what he was ultimately going to do? And the answer is no. God just usurped all those people, if you will. Great vernacular. I wouldn't want to be usurped by God, but that's basically what he does. Look at Numbers 14:33. That's just one example. Your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they will suffer for your unfaithfulness. But notice, until your corpse lie in the wilderness. In other words, this is another way of saying that generation will die in the wilderness. And then God will take their, if you will, offspring, and the offspring will be the ones to go into the promised land. So the people missed out on what God had because they were what? Disobedient. But on the other hand, were God's plans forfeited? No. God still fulfilled what he was going to promise to do. So the wilderness there was due to disobedience. And the funny thing with that, I've always thought, and to be honest with you, is that God had done all these miraculous things through Moses, as he just said, but yet the people still disobeyed God. So there's some root reason why God's people tend to disobey him, and we'll see it in the second part of the speech here with Moses. So we've seen that, but let's go back to sort of the verse references. So we've covered up through Acts 7:36, but let's look at these last two. Moses, did Moses ever foretell of the coming of Messiah? Actually, if you notice in here, and this would be not, hopefully you don't get lost here switching chapters. This is Acts 7:37. When Jean was reading it, notice it says, "This is the Moses who said to the sons of Israel," and this is a direct quotation here, "God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your brethren." This is one of those prophecies that are called messianic prophecies. This is Deuteronomy 18:15. So if you go back to Deuteronomy 18:15, it's towards the end of Moses' life. And a short version of the prophecy would be this. I'm going to die. God's going to raise up the prophet. It's a definite article. There's going to be one prophet that comes sometime in the future. He'll eclipse all of the prophets. And he'll bring about the promises of God. And who is that? That is Jesus. We know that one is used repeatedly in the New Testament. And I want you to think about something. Who accepted that prophet? Was it Stephen or the Sanhedrin? See what he's doing? He's saying, look, I accepted the prophecy. I accepted the prophet that was prophesied. This one through whom Moses was speaking of. What about you? Why did you reject him? And so that's what he's getting here. It's brilliant. If you think about it, off the top of his head, he's getting ready to get martyred and he's able to do this. So that is what he's doing. He's saying, in effect, how did you miss it? I accepted him. Maybe you're the problem with not interpreting Moses correctly, would be another way to say it. But then lastly, when Gene was reading, he goes through here and talks about the congregation. It's the community would be actually a better way to probably interpret that. But anyway, they were in the wilderness. But notice the very ending before we move to verses 39 through 43. Notice Moses received living oracles to pass along to you. And what do you think those are? Well, you have it sitting in your lap. Right? It's the Bible. Right. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't take much of an epiphany. That would be the idea of Exodus 19 through 20. But I would take that a little bit more and just say those would be the writings, of course, we have of Moses. What did Moses write? Genesis through Deuteronomy. So two things just real quick, and then we'll move to the last piece here. So verse 36, the Lord cared for his people in miraculous ways in order to fulfill his promises to Abraham, yet The people disobeyed and spent 40 years in the wilderness, and they missed out on what God had for them. But the question would be, why? When we go to read verses 39 through 43, Stephen continues, and he really hammers home finally with Moses that the people were disobedient, and what they did is they rejected the messenger of God. And ergo, when you reject the messenger of God, what are you basically doing? You're rejecting God. It's sort of another way of saying the same thing. And we'll find out what is the root cause of why they kept doing this. And it's not as complicated as you think. So someone read 39 through 43, and that will finish us up through the time of Moses. Anyone want to read 39 through 43?
I'll do it. You said 39 through 43?
Yep.
Our fathers were unwilling to be obedient to him to worship. I will also remove you beyond Babylon.
All right, thank you. All right, so if we look at 39 through 43, this will, if you're taking notes, this will finish Stephen's defense using Moses, okay? So let's cover these verses real quick, and then I'll point out a few things. And you probably, if you paid attention to the reading, probably already know what the core issue is. I mean, he tells you, but we'll get to that momentarily. So in chapter 7, verse 39, Israel rejected Moses and they longed to return to Egypt. That would be, there's several places, but I'll just give you one reference. Numbers 14, verses 3 through 4. And I'll just go ahead and tell you, you see what the issue is, isn't it? It says their hearts turned back to Egypt. So God had done all this for them, manna and all that, whatever you want to say. But yet, what did they do? In their hearts, they turned back. So what is man's problem? What was the root cause? Their hearts weren't right with God. It's a very simple lesson. The issue is always the heart. And more times out of not, that's what happens. So in verse 39 of Acts 7, Israel rejected Moses, but they, of course, wanted to return to Egypt, which just seems crazy, doesn't it? You know, it would be, and I know I've used this before on Sunday morning. It's like, Lord, bring us a new pastor. And we'll be happy. You bring the new pastor and he comes in and what happens? Take us back to the old one. You know, whatever it is, we tend to do that, don't we? The grass is always greener or whatever God does. But it's typically an issue of the heart, isn't it? And that's what the main thing is. Now, what notice when Merritt was reading verses 40 through 41, they made a golden calf while Moses was on the mountain. After all, God did all of that. And who helped? Aaron, you know, I mean, God's people left on their own without a servant of the Lord, what will they naturally do? They go to other things that they naturally do. They made an idol and they celebrated these sacrifices. So rather than worship the one who brought them out of Egypt, they made a god for themselves in a sense. So that would be Exodus, if you're not familiar. That's Exodus 32, verses 1 through 6. Now, finally, verses 42 through 43. I don't know if you picked up on the term because it's slightly different, but I'm going to want to mention it. Notice verse 42. What did God do? In a sense, he gave them over to themselves. He turns away from them and he delivers them. God is said to do that to people in the New Testament. Do you know where? Romans chapter 1, verses 24 through 28. God gives people over to themselves eventually. So God gave his own people over to, and I appreciate Merritt's accurate pronunciations of those weird names in there, and that's in verse 43. Now, if you don't notice, the one Ramphah, I can't even hardly say it myself, almost need her to say it again. Does anyone know which God this was, lowercase g? They thought that it related to, basically, they thought it was a God that had relations to what we would call today the planet Saturn. So, if you're curious, that's just the idea there. But the idea is God gave the people over and let them, in a sense, have it to fend for themselves, we would call it today. So God turns them over to themselves. It's reminiscent to Romans chapter 1, 24 through 28, which I would submit to you is probably the worst thing that can happen. Because essentially what it means in English is God abandons you and you have to fend for yourself. That's probably the worst judgment God can give. And so despite God's grace, the people turn to idols and continue to resist his word. Now, for a bit of trivia, Does anyone know what those quotations are from the prophets in 42 through 43? It's Amos, famous Amos, chapter 5, verses 25 through 27. Amos 5, 25 through 27. So Stephen's quoting one of the minor prophets. You know, if you go to Hosea, Jonah, Joel, it's shortly right in there. Amos 5, 25 through 27. And this is Amos, if you're not familiar with that prophet, that's one of the 12 minor prophets. Amos foretells of the northern kingdom's eventual judgment. And what happened? Did God eventually judge the nation through Babylon and so forth? These people knew it very well, the ones he was speaking to here. So that's a direct quotation if you're curious where he gets that from. That's Amos 5, 25 through 27. So when I started, I said that Israel, now, did they have a lot of knowledge? Did they have a lot of evidence that God was with them? Did they have a lot of proof, in other words, that God was with them and was going to fulfill his promises? Of course they did. So what was their problem? Their heart, right? Because that's where typically the problems lie. And God had given them all the evidence. He had seen all these miraculous things. Their heart wasn't right. So what did they do? They just essentially left God and were disobedient, which is what Stephen's trying to show. He's trying to show that Abraham was given all of these promises pointing to Messiah. All along the way, God was overriding the people's rejection just as he was doing with Jesus. I'm going to end with something here. It's the hymn. I'm sure you know it. Come Thou Fount Every Blessing. It's this one piece of it. And I thought it would be good because it speaks about the heart and not wandering from God, in a sense, which is sort of the idea of what Stephen's making here. Come Thou Fount Every Blessing, this by Robinson. This one portion of the hymn says, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, oh, take it and seal it. Seal it in it, excuse me, for thy courts above. God needs our hearts because the heart is the centerpiece of us in many ways. If you want to read ahead for next time, what we'll look at next time is verses 44 through 53, which finishes the speech or the defense. And what he's going to do is move to the tabernacle, the temple, and then he's going to bring the charge against them. And then in the final study, which will be part 8, he is martyred. Seems crazy that you'd be martyred for the truth, but it happens. Huh? All right. Comments, questions? Need me to repeat anything?